Well, good morning, all. This is day one, class one, in the class entitled Seeing Christ Through the Wilderness Tabernacle. So, our first day or so, we want to transition this host of about 2 million out of Egypt into the encampment at Mount Horeb, where the rest of the class will unfold. The tents that were encamped around the tabernacle and the inner core of the priests were all of black goat hair, symbolizing the tremendous difference in spiritual preparation and worldliness to the inner core of priests, and of course the righteousness represented by the white peripheral fencing of the actual tabernacle itself. This is a study of God manifestation. And for that familiar definition, I'm reading to you out of Exodus 3, where Moses asked, "What am I to say is his name? What shall I say unto them?" And God said unto Moses, "I am that I am." And he said, "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you." And God said moreover unto Moses, "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Yahweh of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you, that is, my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations." So, just like the cherubim oracle east of Eden that was established as a teaching oracle early on in Genesis, God desired a place where he could meet with his people, a people chosen for his name, and this principle moved the building of Solomon's temple eventually, and it will drive the kingdom age temple with the great Ezekiel's temple built on the holy oblation. And this was a teaching memorial as well, this tabernacle in the wilderness. Now, a host of approximately 2 million, it's estimated, came out of Egypt, and that figure is derived from the actual figure of 600,000 men that we have, and so in the rendering of that with the elderly and the children and so forth, the figure has become typically roughly 2 million people wrenched out of Egypt through the mighty arm of God, at the expenses and the total shambles that left of Egypt at that time. They never really recovered after that exodus. This mixed multitude, we're told, was washed, think baptized, in the Red Sea, and this began their prerequisite of sanctification to God, which of course took place once they arrived at Sinai. I'm going to read for a second from 1 Corinthians 10, if you'd like to go there with me. 1 Corinthians 10. "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual food, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not just after evil things, not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Neither be you idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us put Christ to the test, as some of them also tested him and were destroyed by serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. So this is a summary then, that the tabernacle in the wilderness was given for our example. Now in the Old Testament, under Moses, we have the mechanics of this system laid out. The blueprint, if you will, given to Moses on the mount in the presence of the 70 elders, primarily at their first trek up the mountain. But the explanation of these things is unfolding throughout the New Testament. That's where we get the input on what these things mean. We listen to Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. And this is a quote that you'll recognize from Matthew 2 as a secondary application, referring as of Jesus, the babe, who likewise came out of Egypt. And in essence, all of us come out of Egypt, don't we, once we are called and put on Christ through baptism. Jesus was the greater servant son after the type of the greater servant nation, which will be so in the kingdom age. Now, this was all accomplished through the blood of Christ. And as we were looking at last night, the blood of Christ, the blood of the everlasting covenant, is a term that we're familiar with. We use it frequently in our teaching. But here's an example of the blood that was given by Christ in his ratifying sacrifice. I'm reading out of Isaiah 52, and I'm reading out of verse 14. As many were astounded at thee, his visage was also marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Now, we don't really think of Christ being that brutalized in his trial and treatment under the soldiers prior to his act of crucifixion. But when you think of the preparatory stages of a criminal, they were brutalized by the Romans. So in the footnote here, my Bible says, the literally rendering presents a shocking picture. So marred from the form of man was his aspect that his appearance was not that of a son of man, i.e., not human. So we read the rather couched terms of Christ being spat upon and smitten with closed hand, open palm, etc. But he was apparently beaten to the extent that he was really marred and his whole face, facial features were unrecognizable. The wilderness tabernacle taught a divine process of God manifestation, and it's through the movement of obedient men, a designated race called early on Hebrews, and called out of the world through the front door of the courtyard, if you will, into a sojourn in the holy place, ultimately blessed to gaze into the most holy place, which was the prize and is the final destination of all of us. By means of its many features, Yahweh revealed to his people his own glory and what he required as a basis for faith. This early tabernacle arrangement teaches God's divine plan and purpose for his ecclesia of saints from the beginning, for the here and now, and for the future. This is a salvation device that doesn't end until the very end of the apocalypse. So this tabernacle has been called Yahweh's dwelling place. in the wilderness. Nothing has changed from the wilderness of Sinai to the present day wilderness that we live in. This is a parable for the ages of God's plan. After the example of this people in their wilderness struggles, we consider Jesus. And lastly, when we extract Jesus out of this parable and these teachings, we look at ourselves. Where do we fit into this as we sojourn in the wilderness of men? Therefore, this is a three-dimensional study. You think Yahweh, you think manifestation in His Son Jesus, and then we have to look at ourselves and say, what's the application for ourselves? So we want to look at these basic mechanics of this structure, its application to mortal believers, its fulfillment then in Jesus, and then lastly, its fulfillment in us as the ecclesia now in the wilderness. So this study is steeped in type, countertype, parable, parallelisms, inferences, and conclusions, which we'll all be familiar with. So that's what this second overhead defines for it. And I put this up here for Tommy Asbell. He's the guy that likes all of these things. Things taught in this tabernacle wilderness. First and always, the glory of Yahweh has to prevail and be seen out of each type and piece of furniture and application. Secondly, we want to look at this and ask ourselves, how was this fulfilled in Jesus? How did He fulfill these types? And lastly, we want to look at it and see, how can this be fulfilled in me and you, a people chosen for His name? Let me take a look at Hebrews 5 for just a minute. Read that into the record. Hebrews 5, 8 to 9. Though He were a son, yet learned He obedience by the things which He suffered, and being made perfect, He became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey Him. Perfect is complete, as in reaching a goal. And our perfection doesn't end in our sojourn until we put on immortality. That's the end stage of achieving perfection. Hosea 11 verse 1 tells us that Yahweh's Son would also come out of Egypt, just like His sonship found in His nation of Israel. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. So you see the tier here of how this progresses. The nation, God's Son, you and I. Jesus was introduced to the nation as the Passover lamb that should save through His blood spread on the lintels of the faithful's doorpost in their wrenching out of Egypt. The vertical doorpost speaks to the Mosaic and the everlasting covenant that is taught and portrayed out of this tabernacle parable. The lintel, I believe, is the horizontal, and Christ's blood links both the Mosaic covenant and the everlasting covenant. As the fledgling nation was baptized in the Red Sea, so was Jesus under His cousin John Baptist. And there He was led into the wilderness and tested. So as we reflect upon our personal lives and the tests that we've experienced along the way, specifically after coming into covenant, we gain much strength that we can continue on in our wilderness journey, and that Yahweh has been merciful, and that our character has only been further refined by what we've experienced. Regarding us, all that were ever called, the principle is exactly the same. The pattern demands separation from the world, from all who would become part of the family of God. And in the first opening overhead, you recall all the black tents around the tabernacle confines. The people lived in black goat hair tents. Goats, they were a mixed multitude. As things were further sifted down, we got to the white encampment of the Levites who protected and surrounded the tabernacle in the wilderness, further defined by the white linen fence of righteousness that kept it further separated from the host. Now in Acts 15:14 it stated, God first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. This parable is further developed in 1 Corinthians 10, 1-11, which we've read already. Like the wilderness ecclesia, sonship depends upon separation. And another prime teaching parallel to it was obedience. Separation and obedience. Nothing new to us today, is it? Now, when we reach Marah, and this occurred 3 days out from the crossing of the Red Sea, supplies had typically grown thin. Water was always needed, but here was abundant water that turned out to be bitter, brackish, no doubt, and generating much murmuring from the people. Something that was to occur all too regularly, over 9 times. And this then comes out of Exodus 15:23, if you want to read this on your own. This is a very large, barren area. It's punctuated by the Mitla Pass, and it was described by Rawlinson as treeless, waterless, and destitute of heritage. The blowing easterly winds would have blasted sand in the face of the travelers as they journeyed in a southeasterly direction. That tree designated that was thrown into the water for healing the bitter waters of life is rendered a gallows tree. And it's the same rendering found in Esther 5:14, so we make the connection there in regards to the fate of the wicked Haman. The wages of sin is death. The tree upon which Jesus was destined to be crucified upon, and thus signifying the curse of the law, was capable of changing the bitterness of life and the spiritual drought into sweetness. It was only if we only identify ourselves with it by water, which we do through immersion. Now, this occurring in Exodus 15, it's an exhortation to give earnest heed to the upcoming formal presentation of the law, lest the populace succumb to the diseases of Yahweh that he put upon the Egyptians, and in this case, bad water. Here Yahweh introduces by name, a new name we might say, relatively new name for Yahweh, and it's Yahweh Rophekah, R-O-P-H-E-K-A, Yahweh the physician, Raphe, is to heal thoroughly, to repair, to stitch together, to mend by stitching. And this then complies nicely to a word that it's akin to is religion, which means to rejoin or to rebind. And certainly in the making of the wilderness tabernacle structure, there is much stitching when it comes to the glorious fabric in the veil and in the overhead covering, which was made of fine needlework and specifically of the cherubim. So Yahweh the healer was going to be just that if the people in the worship of the tabernacle could visualize and see what they were surrounded with. They were going to be immersed in the healing benefits and options of Yahweh as one entered the courtyard and progressed to the veil into the most holy place. This drives home the God manifestation in the future healer who can heal man spiritually and thus repair the greatest breach that has ever occurred between God and man through his original sin. The situation was the first time that the people are described as murmuring against Moses. And as I said, it was to occur 9 more times. Now imagine the sound, the groundswell of 2 million people murmuring in a given area. That's what Moses and Yahweh had to contend with. And you can hear this ripple through crowds, but imagine 2 million people in a complaining, murmuring mood. Murmuring is a negative response to difficult or depressing circumstances. It tends to be catching, and it was condemned by the apostles. Recorded instances were over 3 times water, over food 2 times, out of jealousy by Miriam and Aaron, out of fear and jealousy at the spies' report. Half of the murmurings, we're told, were for this world's goods or comforts, as well as over bitterness, fear, and cowardice, all resulted from lack of faith from a sustaining power, as if they haven't witnessed that sustaining power by now. Now, we have some additional thoughts as they journeyed along in their sojourn and they came to the waters of Marah and Elam. The murmurings of people against Moses foreshadowed that of the leaders of the Jews against Christ some 1,500 years later. And remember that this wilderness journey, which does include the design and giving of the tabernacle as a parable in itself, represents life's salvation model injected into the center of it, and it represents our sojourn as well. Do we murmur as brethren? It's something we need to really close our lips on if we find ourselves in that position. They traveled deeper into the Sinai then, moving this host through a barren landscape and into the wilderness of Sin, and the host camps at Elam. This is out of Exodus 15, around verse 27. And here there were found 12 wells of water and an oasis of 70 palm trees. Palm trees, Elam, is a contrast to the bitterness of Marah, and it's rendered powerful ones. It figuratively leaves behind humanity struggling with its various diseases, principally its mortality. And it's a projection into the kingdom age, where through the powerful ones of both Jew and Gentile, the Israel of God can now water the mortal nations. Where do we get these thoughts from? There were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, we're told. Elam rendered powerful ones. The 12 wells of water speaks to the 12 tribes of Israel, and it speaks to their 12 Jewish administrators in the kingdom age, the apostles who will sit on the 12 thrones, judging and managing those 12 tribes as they take it into the Olam. The 70 palm trees speaks to ordinal and divine completion. And this speaks to the immortal Gentile saints who have watered at the 12 Israel wells and who now are enjoined to Israel as our plan of salvation, and who will take the hope of Israel likewise under the guise of the 12 administering apostles and will teach the mortal nations all to their edification and salvation. It figuratively leaves behind humanity struggling with its various diseases, this oasis of 70 palm trees, and it's a projection into the kingdom age through the powerful ones. Now, between Elam and Mount Sinai, the final destination for this class and this little saga, there was to be more testing along the way at Rephidim. As the food rations grew thin again, it gave the people occasion for further murmuring. Bread from heaven was rained down, and quails were sent as meat to feed the people. Their murmurings against Moses were rightly interpreted as sin against Yahweh. It's doubtful that this generation of people made any connection to the future of Christ by their feeding of the manna and the quail. We can only hope that eventually the Levitical hierarchy was able to spread the word emanating out of the core to the populace who would listen as to what the meaning of this really was. They would continue to receive this bread from heaven for the next 40 years, where it types the duration of our eating of the Son of God as our life-saving diet until he returns and we may see him face to face. Now, in Exodus 17, there is again need of water. This then provokes a confrontation to Moses, through Moses, to Yahweh himself. Moses cries out there, "Almost ready to stone me." His patience is wearing thin. As instructed Moses, he smote the Christ rock and produced water for the people. The living water gushed out, teaching life without reservation. And this was to be Yahweh's gift. If you'll turn with me, please, to Psalm 78. This has been known as the Moses Rock, and H.P. Mansfield mentions this rock when he traveled the Sinai and the nation of Israel extensively, I believe in the 50s. And this Moses Rock provided such a prolific source of water for literally centuries that it watered that whole region of the Sinai. H.P. felt that when he had found that rock, I guess it's a distinct rock, and it's about a 10-foot square rock full of holes and fissures and cracks. Anyway, it made for an interesting account. Now, reading from Psalm 78, verse 13 to 29. "And he divided the sea and caused them to pass through, and he made the waters to stand as a heap. In the daytime also he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink as out of the great depths. He brought streams also out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. And they sinned yet more against him by provoking the Most High in the wilderness. And they tested God in their heart by asking food according to their desire. Yea, they spoke against God. They said, 'Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Behold, he smote the rock that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide flesh for his people?' Therefore the Lord heard this and was angry. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they believed not in God and trusted not in his salvation, though he had commanded the clouds from above and opened the doors of heaven, and had rained down manna upon them and had given them of the grain of heaven. Man did eat angels' food, He sent them food to the full. Imagine the nutrition this manna must have had. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He rained flesh also upon them like dust, and feathered fowls like the sand of the sea. And he let it fall in the midst of their camp round about their habitations. So they did eat and were well filled, for he gave them their own desire. So this then becomes a parable of the ability of Yahweh to feed his own with a nutritious food, i.e., the mind and diet we have when we feed upon Christ. This parable of life's needs deepened with the attack of Amalek. And this was another obstacle they had to overcome, reminding the congregation at that time that sin is ever present, dogging one's lives, picking off the weak and the strugglers. So simultaneous with the need for water, the end of the host being thirsty, tired, representing the more infirm, I'm sure, they were beset and vulnerable to the attack of one Amalek. Sin attacks those with their guard down. That's always something to remember. Amalek has been rendered as a strangler of the people. Sin is a strangler, however it's applied and experienced. He was a descendant of Esau. We find that in Genesis 36. He's typically represented as flesh in political manifestation and belligerent, Amalek. Now, according to Josephus, the army of Amalek was composed of a confederacy of powers. So he was like a magnet to the dissidents and the rebels in the region. And this is also what we're going to see in Ezekiel 38 when we consider that host of Gog, do we not? An amalgamation of dissidents and rebels. Balaam later described the tribe as the first of the nations out of Numbers 24, whose latter end shall be that he perish forever. The king of Amalek is given the name of Agag out of Numbers 24, and although this is thought to be a title much like Pharaoh is, it's rendered Gog in the Septuagint. So we get the connect, don't we? Therefore, this is seen as a type of the great end-time battle and conflict between organized sin manifested in flesh and the encampment of saints to be led by Christ in its annihilation. Now, out of Exodus 17, verse 16, this states that Yahweh will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And this is in reference to Yahweh's unceasing hostility to fleshly institutions that exist in opposition to him. In Exodus 17:12, Moses' hands were heavy when he was compelled to hold his hands up so that the children of Israel in their resistance might be able to prevail. And so his hands were assisted. It's tiring to resist sin, is it not? Whether it's a personal struggle, whether it's around us in various manifestations, it's tiring and it's sapping. He was also blessed to have a stone that he could sit upon. So enter Jesus in the metaphor of the stone, which is a strong metaphor all the way through Scripture. The word for stone is Eben, E-B-E-N, and it's from a root meaning sun. No coincidence here. So Moses was strengthened through the sun, or the presence of Jesus, that was only to be made more manifest to him as this parable unfolds. Jesus is brought forth as the prophetic stone in one of its developmental phases. So from Isaiah 28:16, I'm quoting, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation." Isaiah 28:16 summarizes this metaphor nicely as it is to unfold throughout Scripture. Now, the destruction of Amalek was commanded for King Saul to destroy, but he didn't get that job done. David greatly weakened Amalek, but he was finally destroyed under Hezekiah in 1 Chronicles 4:43. Moses' victory was to be recorded as a memorial, rendered an awakening, and given to Joshua, the successor to Moses and the future leader of Israel. This was relayed in chapter 17. So we might ask ourselves, what was to be remembered by this encounter? The attack of Amalek came suddenly against the weakened rear of the nation, a type of sin in its various forms and manifestation, weakened from desire and murmuring. Ecclesial standards and ecclesial stewards are mindful of danger that can impact an ecclesia, and hopefully move to head them off before they are so devastating that they destroy the ecclesia. This is something that ecclesial stewards must learn to do, is to recognize sin snapping on the heels of the ecclesia and be able to move to take action before it's too late. King Agag returns in the type of Haman, the proverbial Jew hater, and the type of all Jew haters throughout history. And the anti-type is the wave of anti-Semitism that we see today impacting Europe and all over the world now, destined to crescendo under the papacy and to challenge Christ upon his advent. And of course we see this as an organized belligerence in Ezekiel 38. Now the warning in Ezekiel 13 verse 5 is relevant here. "You have not gone up into the gaps, neither made up the hedge for the house of Israel to stand in the battle in the day of the Lord." So, although there are those who criticize contenders, this is a verse that allows us to realize it's necessary to step into the gaps in the spiritual hedge in order to head off pending danger. I really suspect that the representative of Agag will be instrumental in the rebellion at the end of the 1,000 years. Now, the greater than David will prevail in his destruction of Amalek as an outflow of Ezekiel 38. This overhead is a comparison of what the manna and quail represent. When you read it, you can read from left to right. A divinely provided wafer meeting all necessities for life, described as angel's food. In John 6:31, Jesus is the true bread from heaven that giveth life unto the world. Type, quail, manna came out of the wilderness, as described in Ezekiel 16, associated with the glory of Yahweh being revealed out of the wilderness. Antitype, John Baptist from the wilderness of spiritual drought proclaimed Jesus. And Matthew 3, at his baptism, the glory of God was made flesh and was able to be beholded. type, this literal food had limited mortal life sustaining value. The antitype, Jesus the true bread, is immortal life sustaining power, and the fact that he was resurrected after his crucifixion is our conduit and hope to what lies ahead. Now, I want to take a rabbit trail for just a minute. I think I can get it in. When we look a little harder at this manna and quail that was provided. This mixed multitude was now a month and a half out from Egypt, considering Israel's 30 days for a month criteria. And I'm in Exodus for a second, Exodus 16, and I'll read from verse 1 to 8. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came unto the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full, for you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Then said the Lord unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain amount every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. And Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel at evening, Then you shall know that the Lord hath brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning when you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he heareth your murmurings against the Lord, and what are we that you murmur against us? So they were taking it personally, of course. They were the buffer between the murmuring people and God. And Moses said, This shall be when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, for the Lord heareth your murmurings which you murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but they're against the Lord. So, when we murmur or complain, either to ourselves and or in public, we are really murmuring against God. Because the reality was that no murmur against Moses and Aaron was isolated. It was murmuring against Yahweh. To smite some murmurings in the furthest parts of the camp, we're told in Numbers, and this came out of Numbers 11. And since I'm out of time, I'll pick up this little snippet before we move on next hour.